Hi, I'm Rich Burrows, and I'm community manager at Gremlin.
And I'm Jacob Plick, a solutions architect at Gremlin. And welcome to Break Things on Purpose, a podcast about chaos engineering.
So here we are at episode 2. We're really excited. In a minute, we'll be going to our interview with Michael Keough from LinkedIn. But we just want to thank all of you who listened to the first episode and let you know that you can reach out to us if you have comments or feedback or questions.
Absolutely. So our email is podcast@gremlin.com. And you can also find us on Twitter at BTOPPOD, that's BTOP Pod on Twitter. And we'll put that info in the show notes as well.
So Jacob, what's something that stood out for you in our conversation with Michael Keough?
So yeah, when thinking back on it, one thing that was really key for me was the taking the learnings of a chaos engineering practice and seeing how an organization matures from that. They use a few different applications in order to accomplish the experiments that they run, which we'll get into in the interview. And I think that it was really, really interesting to see what happens or how you kind of get started and move forward long-term with a chaos engineering practice versus a small project. What about you?
Well, I agree with you completely. I mean, what they're doing is really advanced there, and it was great to hear about. I think the most fun thing for me was hearing about Michael's experience at NASA building satellites. And again, we'll get into that more in the interview.
But yeah, it's so crazy. It's so awesome. Yeah, I'm so excited for people to hear that.
I find it really, really interesting because, you know, we live in this world where, you know, we're building software, but we're iterating on it all the time, you know? And so if there's a problem, we just patch it. And it's such a different world when you think of the kind of work that those people at NASA do and other space programs where you're building something that's going to go up into space and you're not patching it tomorrow, right?
Yep.
So when you think about like shifting left, you know, and making sure that you've got everything working right, you know, as early as possible, this is sort of the ultimate shift left kind of scenario.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I'm really excited to for folks to give it a listen. So without further ado, let's get to the interview with Michael.
So we are here today with Michael Keough. Michael is a staff site reliability engineer at LinkedIn. Welcome, Michael.
Thanks for having me on the podcast.
Oh, we really appreciate you joining us.
Absolutely.
So can we just start off? Some of our audience might not actually know what a site reliability engineer is. Can you maybe give a little bit of an overview of what it is that you do?
Sure. So site reliability engineering is great fusion of software engineering and operations. So as a site reliability engineer, I need to be proficient in obviously software engineering, but also understanding how the Linux kernel works and how networking works, how to troubleshoot systems, how to design monitoring, as well as being able to architect those systems.
So that sounds like a lot of things to know about.
Definitely.
What do you mean? It seems so simple, right? It's interesting because I think that it's popularized a lot now, especially with the Google SRE books and things like that. But it's, I'd say, for lack of a better term, a discipline that's been around for a really, really long time. Did you sort of bring up on the software engineering side and then kind of switch over to the reliability side? Or were you more of the on the infrastructure side and then the code kind of caught up to it?
So when I was about 11 or 12, I was about to go on a really long overseas trip. And, you know, I bought some magazines to take on the plane. And this magazine had an introduction to what was called Windows Avalon there, which some of your listeners might know now as Windows Presentation Platform in Microsoft. And that sort of piqued my interest in coding. They had all these cool new glossy features that looked really interesting and sort of caught my attention. And from, you know, reading that magazine and then going and finding videos online, I got really into coding at about that age. And then during class in high school, you know, did as many courses, as many projects as I could. And then sort of took a bit of a pivot when I went to university and decided to study electrical engineering. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, electrical engineering does have somewhat of a software component. But I got really interested in the operations side after we had some people come and visit the university and talk about site reliability engineering. I saw it as this great fusion of being able to touch all these different things and sort of being able to continually learn. And sort of that's what really got me into this space. So I spent a lot of time teaching myself about site reliability engineering, what it means. And, you know, once I joined LinkedIn, I really enjoyed the culture of, you know, being able to work with people, being able to work through problems, design things, and, you know, take something that might be difficult or complicated and make it work, not only from an engineering standpoint, but from a business standpoint as well.
That's fantastic. I've heard a lot of people talk about that idea of having a learning mentality, you know, and how much of a difference that makes in someone's career.
Yeah, it's definitely something that's important. Obviously, our industry changes so quickly. There's always something new to learn. So it's sort of a pride point of mine to try and be on top of, you know, whatever the new technology is. So this year, I'm spending more time on, you know, some of the new Linux kernel features, as well as some of the new WebAssembly platform functionality that's coming into browsers. And that's sort of my little goal for the year, to push myself professionally.
Nice. So it's like a combination of also, like, you know, kind of staying ahead of the curve, but also, like, it's something that you're passionate and legitimately interested in. So it's nice that kind of pyramid comes together in that way.
For sure.
So I was looking at your LinkedIn page, and I think that I saw something mentioned on there about you building small satellites at NASA, and the nerd in me just can't not ask about that.
Yes. While I was in university, I was given this great opportunity to do an internship at NASA Ames, which is just down the road from us here at LinkedIn. And we were working on this really cool concept. It was basically a prototype at the time, where they were looking to build these small satellites called CubeSats, which are 4 by 4 by 4 inches big. So they're, you know, they're pretty small. And we put an Android phone in them and use the Android phone to do all of the computation for the satellite.
Oh, wow.
So this internship became a part of my thesis project. So at that time, NASA was finishing their 1.0 version. And part of my internship, I helped them do some, for lack of a better word, regression testing on their software. And then for my thesis, I looked at how to iterate on this design and improve it. So we found this really cool platform called IOBoard, which allowed us to natively connect the Android phone onto all of this IO busway, which allowed us to control a number of the sensors and mechanical parts of the satellite. And we made a reasonable improvement on the design without any cost overhead. So just for the record, like, we're building these satellites at a, you know, $3,000 to $10,000, which is very cheap in the realm of satellite development. After the internship, they launched a set of these satellites into a low Earth orbit, and they successfully completed their mission, which was 11 days long, I believe. So that was an awesome opportunity and definitely gave me this great background on sort of working on multiple disciplines. So there was a little bit of mechanical there, and then a lot of electrical and a lot of software.
Nice. That's awesome. Yeah, that sounds once in a lifetime, literally. How do you think that kind of brought you into from a site reliability kind of engineering perspective? How did that help kind of tie that together for you and brought you to where you are today?
Like, for these satellites, you know, they're an expensive investment. Like, we're building small satellites, but, you know, the rocket you're still using is expensive. So they cannot fail. So we were spending some time, you know, looking at ways where we could sort of prod various parts of the platform and make sure that things didn't catastrophically fail. At one point, we actually found a bug in the phone software, which actually rebooted the phone. So through this testing, we actually had to develop a way where the satellite could gracefully come back up and sort of resume operations within a small time frame. Man. So definitely, you know, reliability was very much front and center of this project.
Wow, that sounds almost terrifying and exciting at the exact same time.
Yeah, I think that's a part of being a site reliability engineer. You've got this great responsibility, and, you know, you are always looking for ways to make it as reliable as possible and give the people using your platform the best experience possible. So this internship was definitely a good avenue into what I do as a day job now. Obviously, you know, now I'm helping make the LinkedIn member experience the best I possibly can be. But then, you know, it was making sure that this very expensive investment we had made did not fail during its mission.
Yeah. So let's talk about what you're doing at LinkedIn. So I read a piece that you wrote for an InfoQ magazine about chaos engineering that talked a little bit about what you're doing there. There's a project called Water Bear, I think.
Yeah.
Can you kind of talk us through that a little bit?
So WaterBear is LinkedIn's main chaos engineering project. So I'm sure we'll include the link to the article in the show notes.
Yes, absolutely.
But we basically look at three of our main chaos engineering tools. So the first one is FireDrill, which is our host level fault injection platform. So we can go and manipulate network, CPU, and disk components of a system and see how the application and infrastructure responds. The second one, which is probably the coolest, is LinkedOut, where we can take a LinkedIn page and then go and fail downstream calls just for that test user and see what happens to the end user experience. This is really cool. So if you go and look at the LinkedIn homepage, we have many downstream microservices serving that page. So what we can go and do is go and selectively fail some of those downstream calls by either making them time out or making them throw an error back and then see how that, you know, front end responds and what the user sees.
That's fantastic.
And the best part about it is we're only doing it for that particular, you know, LinkedIn engineer testing it. This does not affect the member experience.
Gotcha. So you can kind of actively test in production while only, you know, having the blast radius as small as that particular user.
Yes.
And then that particular request as well, and then see how that degrades and, you know, if that affects performance.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a very flexible platform that gives us, you know, a lot of granularity to see, you know, what the, if this like one particular API endpoint became unavailable or became slow, what the exact impact to the end user would be. And again, as you said, the blast radius is literally contained to that one person who's testing that. So there's no impact on the rest of the engineers at LinkedIn, and there is no impact to the end member.
Wow.
And then so the final piece we have is our D2 tuner project. So LinkedIn has this API transport layer called Restly, which basically allows our services to discover each other and then talk to each other over a HTTP JSON protocol. In this Restly framework, we have server-side timeouts, which are sort of globally defined, and D2 tuner basically collects all the operational metrics for how that service performs normally, and then provides us recommendations on what those global timeouts should be. By default, in the past, our default timeout has been rather large, which has caused us some issues. And then using this D2 tuner platform, we can go and optimize those timeouts to make sure that, you know, if the system is going to hit some problems, we can fail that call as quickly as possible and then let it retry or let the application gracefully degrade.
Oh, wow. So was that kind of the V3? Because like as you were mentioning it, my mind kind of went to thinking about console for service discovery and then, you know, application level fault injection, adding to that piece. And then so was this created as a result of doing some chaos engineering experiments? Like the reason why I bring that up is, you know, a lot of times when you're creating an app, you're putting together timeouts and a retry logic almost as a best guess, so to speak. And in some cases, maybe you don't even know what the steady state of the application is. So I'm curious to know if that was it just kind of the mindset or was it created after something like an incident?
So I think it was a natural evolution of our infrastructure. So LinkedIn is a rather large software platform. So over the years, we've migrated to this Restly framework. And over time, we saw the need to, you know, make further optimizations into, you know, the operations of it. So definitely there was some people sort of taking the initiative and saying, hey, we can do better here. Part of it was also the LinkedOut platform giving us some hints on, hey, you can probably do this better over here to improve the experience. So it was I don't think there was one sort of catalyst event. It was just sort of like a natural evolution and then, you know, sort of using those chaos engineering outcomes to better inform our operational decisions.
And the project was started after LinkedIn had moved from a monolith to microservices. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, so 1 or 2 years before I joined LinkedIn, we started the move from this very monolithic architecture to this very microservices-based architecture. Now we have a lot of moving parts. We're very proud of our deploy velocity that we have here. And so it's very important for us to be continually testing, you know, all parts of the system, making optimizations where we can, and using this combination of the Water Bear tool suite, we're able to do this, you know, on a daily basis now.
Awesome. Awesome. So you mentioned some chaos engineering experiments where they're and tied into, you know, CPU and, you know, very host level and then touched on application level. Were there ones that kind of top of mind for you that were more useful than the others, for example?
So I'm a bit of a networking nerd. So I definitely started with the network related tests. So in our FireDrill platform, we have the ability to slow down the speed of the network. So my team owns one of the services that interacts with our points of presence. So, you know, latency is a factor, or network latency is a factor in the performance of both my application and the POPs. So we were able to use Water Bear, or use FireDrill more specifically, on this application to go and see, all right, if the network was to degrade, what would be the impact to our infrastructure? And from those tests, we're actually able to make some optimizations so that, you know, if something is not performing as well, we can go and cache that content, or we can go and retry and get that content. The second one that I really like is manipulating the CPU usage, particularly in containers. So behind all the nice Docker or Kubernetes abstractions, on the Linux layer, we have what's called C groups or control groups, which enforce CPU quotas in layman's speak. And how this works, especially when you're using multi-core or multi-threaded processors, or, you know, we're a very Java-heavy application stack here at LinkedIn, understanding how that Java application interacts with high CPU usage in a C group has been very beneficial for us. And it also allows us to go and test our auto-scaling platform to ensure that if we are using more CPU, that we are scaling our infrastructure and application instances accordingly.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's very important.
So specifically to that use case, so, you know, because it's one thing to touch on containers, that's a one piece of the scaling, right? And then from there, how do you kind of switch gears when you need to make a move from a host level perspective, or do those two things even talk to each other?
So with FireDrill, I can basically pick any process and go and manipulate it, which is really cool. So I can limit that blast radius to, you know, one instance. At LinkedIn, we also have a feature called Dark Canaries. So we can go and test new software, like new builds of software in production, where we don't actually affect the responses that go back to the user. So we can go and, you know, really prod at these applications and containers without affecting the member experience, which is very beneficial. So this sort of allows us to do the same sort of things we were doing with LinkedOut on the host level or on the system infrastructure, again, without affecting the end user experience.
While also getting kind of in a little bit deeper, even while you're limiting the blast radius, which is really cool.
Yes.
Awesome.
And as SREs, you know, I really want to know as much as I possibly can about my application. So how it behaves in certain situations, how far can I stress it before it breaks? So I think that makes both my application more resilient, but it also makes me a better engineer because I have a better depth of understanding of the applications that I'm responsible for.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that having that deeper understanding of the applications you're working with is one of the really big benefits of doing chaos engineering. What are some of the other benefits that you've seen from the chaos engineering you all do?
I actually looked at this quote recently, and it's from Donald Rumsfeld, who was then the U.S. Secretary of Defense. And he stated at a Defense Department briefing, "There are known knowns. There are things that we know that we know. There are known unknowns," which is to say that there are things that we know we don't know, but there are also unknown unknowns. So there are things that we know we don't know. And as an SRE, the unknown unknowns really scare me.
Yeah.
You know, I will occasionally wake up in the middle of the night having had a bad dream about, you know, something that I didn't necessarily have the answer to. But chaos engineering gives us an opportunity to shine a light on particularly those unknown unknowns and some of those known unknowns. And the way, particularly that we've done it at LinkedIn, you know, we're able to do that with such a small blast radius where we don't have to impact the end user. So we can really deep dive into those unknown unknowns. And, you know, I can basically do anything I want to an application to understand what happens to it when it is stressed and how I can make it more resilient.
I love too that you're looking at it from the perspective of the user, right? Like that's really what we should always be thinking about is what's the user experience and how we can improve it.
Yeah, one of our core company principles at LinkedIn is members first, and that does extend to our chaos engineering. We're very careful to limit that blast radius, and you know that we've got a great team behind this tooling that has made sure that we've kept that company principle first and foremost when building this suite of tools.
I was reading a bit on your blog as well, and you mentioned in there the idea of using chaos engineering to help break down silos.
Yeah, so I think as an SRE, my technical skills are very important, but also being able to communicate with people is also really, really important. And I did a talk about this last year. So with chaos engineering, there is, you know, endless number of tests that I can go and run within the LinkedIn infrastructure. But, you know, it is also important to talk with people and communicate. So if I'm going to run a chaos test on, you know, a host, I probably need to potentially talk to some of the other tenants on that host.
Sure.
And make sure that they're aware. Equally, if I'm doing a test that may potentially impact an upstream service, you know, I should be reaching out to them and letting them know that you may see this interruption at this time. So there is definitely an expectation within the company that if you are testing something that another person or another team is going to notice, that you proactively reach out and do the right thing. Let them know that, hey, I'm doing this for this benefit. You may see this between this time. Please reach out to me if you're seeing anything and we can resolve the issue.
Right. Or even roll back if need be, right?
Yeah. And of course, equally, hopefully we can build this knowledge repository where from the different tests that people are running, we can go and make optimizations in some of our core infrastructure and core libraries that we use to build the LinkedIn stack. So I think chaos engineering is, you know, naturally a great fit for SREs because, you know, we're already conditioned to be talking and working with, you know, our counterparts in infrastructure engineering, build our data centers and build our networks, as well as the software engineers who are building the software that we support.
Yeah, that seems to be the kind of role that a lot of the practitioners are in right now.
Just to build on that, you know, thankfully with what we've been able to build, a lot of our software engineers really want to go and test this stuff now as well. So since we have a suite of tools where we can go and run tests without impacting the member, you know, any software engineer is able to go and log into these tools, perform tests against their own user account, see how they're, say they wrote a new piece of code or a new feature, they want to go and see, all right, how does my new feature, you know, degrade gracefully? Or what happens if this API is not available? So we're able to, you know, extend some of those cultural paradigms around reliability and operational excellence to the software engineers. And we actually empower them to go and do that on their own without, you know, site reliability engineers having to be involved in that process, which is awesome.
That's actually really huge because that sort of removes you from becoming a single point of failure, right, in that aspect. Because I think a lot of folks, when they think single point of failure, they're very focused on it from, you know, either an infrastructure or an application piece, but it's also just as important from a people perspective. Using the Donald Rumsfeld point there, which I love, you know, even though the unknown unknowns are absolutely terrifying in some cases, you know, being able to prove out those known knowns is just as effective. And it ties directly into, you know, building that knowledge base and saying, hey, this gracefully degrades this way because we performed this experiment on this date and this is what it looks like.
And just one thing on that is with our linked out platform, we're actually able to go and perform regression tests or like chaos engineering regression tests at release time to ensure that we haven't introduced any bugs where we now have either new critical downstreams or the experience degrades because of, you know, something that isn't working in this new code release. So we're able to ensure that we keep that operational excellence over a period of time.
So you've got these tests running as part of your pipeline, and you've got engineers who can kick off one of these tests if they want to. Do you all do game days as well?
There are a number of teams who do game days on what we call in days, which is like the day that LinkedIn gives us to its employees to do whatever they want. It's a great day for us to sort of do something that's not on our sprint that might interest us. So sure. There are definitely some teams who do activities of like what we call Wheel of Doom, where we have a wheel that we spin around with different incident scenarios and we talk through the resolution of that. There are also teams who, you know, might have noticed something in a smaller incident and want to go back and, you know, verify that they're, you know, what they thought happened and, you know, gives them an opportunity to go and file a bug with the developer to go and optimize, you know, whatever that thing they saw was. So there is definitely the practice where teams will go and set aside some time, but equally we've also built the tooling into the culture now where, you know, people will go and do it on their own or have the automatic regression tests running to catch these things straight away.
So where do you see chaos engineering heading in the future? Do you have any thoughts about where things might go?
So I think there is definitely more room to grow in that application infrastructure space. I think for a rather new field, you know, everyone runs on some sort of hardware or in a container, and we've been able to standardize chaos engineering tooling on that. I think we'll eventually get to the point where a number of API layers will have chaos engineering functionality baked into them so we can test what happens to an application when, you know, API calls fail. I think that's the natural evolution in that space. Definitely, we were mentioning, you know, single points of failure with people before as well. Yeah. And hopefully, over time, people will, you know, not only just think about the infrastructure or the applications on that infrastructure, but also think about the human aspect of it. So if a building is unavailable or if a VPN is unavailable, you know, how does the company work around that? And how do we work around, you know, not the non-traditional things that we think about as SRE?
Sure.
And, you know, work to reduce the bus, what we call bus factors in, you know, either people, on-call management, or, you know, even just VPN, which is, you know, very basic for our on-call. What happens if those things aren't available? You know, what is the next step for us to making sure that we can keep the site up and reliable?
Michael, do you have any suggestions for people who want to learn more about chaos engineering?
So there's a lot of great content out there. As we mentioned earlier, there was the InfoQ Mag that we did at the end of last year. There's a number of great contributors, Patrick Higgins, myself, John Allspore, as well as Nora Jones.
Yeah.
There was also recently in New York Chaos Community Day, which was great to hear from a number of different companies, especially some of the smaller companies, about what they're doing in the chaos engineering space. I believe all of those talks are available online. And of course, we semi-regularly post on the LinkedIn engineering blog about our chaos engineering journey. That is something we're continually evolving and something that, you know, we'll continue to talk about publicly as our culture around chaos engineering grows, as well as the tools that we build.
Yeah, that's actually a good kind of question there is the challenges that you folks at LinkedIn faced when kind of proceeding, you know, down a chaos engineering journey. And is there anything that's kind of top of mind for folks wanting to kind of kick that off as they roll out a chaos engineering practice at their own org?
So I think there's two things. Obviously, getting over the stigma and understanding what we're actually trying to do. I know I often hear Colton, the CEO of Gremlin, talk about the cost of outages. And when you actually start thinking about that, you know, it does become quite scary. So if you can run, you know, tests that validate the resiliency of your infrastructure with a small blast radius, the benefits definitely outweigh the risks over a period of time. And I think the other thing to keep in mind is your company doesn't have to be a certain size before you start doing or practicing chaos engineering. Personally, I view it as a craftsmanship thing. So if I am writing code, you know, I want to try and break it in every possible way possible before it goes out into production. So I understand what are its failure cases where I can make it more resilient. And so baking this sort of culture around chaos engineering and sort of going the extra mile to do resiliency testing on your code or your infrastructure, you know, baking that into your culture helps significantly get over any stigma or any challenges around practicing chaos engineering regularly.
Awesome. Couldn't agree more. Yeah, it's as long as you're starting small, you're able to really control that blast radius and find some value.
All right. I think that's all the time that we have, Michael. Before we go, I just want to ask if there's anywhere that people can find you on the internet to read more about what you have to say about these things.
Sure. So you can find me on Twitter at Michael K. Keogh, and my blog is at michael-keogh.io. You'll always find me on LinkedIn, of course, and hopefully on the LinkedIn engineering blog soon.
All right. Thanks so much, Michael. We really appreciate you talking with us. This was a lot of fun.
Absolutely.
All right.
Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
Our music is from Kumiku. The song is titled Battle of Pogs. For more of Kumiku's music, visit loyaltyfreakmusic.com or click the link in the show notes. For more information about our chaos engineering community, visit gremlin.com/community. Thanks for listening, and join us next month for another episode.